This is John Costa with Rob Watson on Spotlight on Art. And this week we're going to be reflecting back over the last 12 weeks. I think we've done about, how many of these were recorded now, Rob? Seven or eight?
We've done 10.
10, have we already? Good Lord. 10 interviews with people about art and their take on it, I guess, their perception on art, you know, who is artistic, what class is as art, and alongside their Spotlight on Heritage that we do. It's a real big reflection of, I think, why Leicester's such an interesting place, because of the amount of people that you can get on. Those 20 people pretty much sum up a very wide selection of people that we've spoken to.
And it feels like we've not even we've not scratched the surface yet.
I think,
as if we're we're just planning the journey. We haven't started the journey yet.
Yeah, we are definitely in the foothills of our podcast creation. Our expedition up this Spotlight on Art and Heritage mounting. I mean, we've had a real mix of people from what, you know, creatives, I would say, that are, you know, using Posca pens through to paint, you know, sort of what people would class, I guess, as an artist, right through to people that are, you know, into music collections, people that have invented a game, people that are doing music and are rapping. There's been a real kind of mix of people. I mean, it's not the sort of thing you'd expect to hear normally, is it, on a Spotlight on Art? It's more about people wandering around galleries, pontificating about the ins and outs of someone's brushstroke.
Well, I suppose we've started off by keeping the boundaries fuzzy. We haven't really drawn a distinction between, well, we've maybe tried to tease it out, but we've not asked the question yet about what is art and what's the difference between creative practice and art. And there's an argument to suggest that the two are actually quite separate and different. Is home decorating art? You know, is craft decorating, is that art? It's very interesting, it's fascinating, but what makes something art is a question to be continually asking. But art with an S in its more general sense encompasses, you know, lots of different activities, lots of different approaches to fashion and creative practices and design and craft work. So it's not the band craft work, the craft of the C work. So.
Do you think people avoid conversations about art and what it is because they feel as if they're got nothing to contribute to it? So unless you are arty yourself or creative and you do creative things and like looking at creative things, art is almost seen as a preserve of people that have got the time to do it. I'm too busy living.
I think we've changed in a way, because we used to, this whole creative industry stuff has just destroyed and broken apart the pleasure and joy of just doing something for itself. You know, and it's like the first thing that you do, you've got some kind, you're interested in drawing. So you go to a business advice session and they say, oh, we'll develop a business plan and we think about scaling this up and you can have an international market. And you're like, I just want to draw pictures, you know, and it's like...
Or colour them in.
At its most basic level. So I think you've got to sort of separate out, you know, the kind of things that you're talking about. I'm not against the creative industries. I think it's a great way to make money if you can do it. But at the same time, let's not get the cart in front of the horse.
Hmm. What do you think? What's been interesting? There you go. I truly am reflecting here. Do you think people have been quite surprised about what our approach has been with Spotlight on Art and how we've spoken to people and the things that we're asking them? Because they almost seem ready to talk about themselves as being a creative. And then we ask them questions and I wasn't expecting you to ask that at all.
Yeah, we've had some great interviews. And I think the range of those interviews and starting from the point of the perspective of finding out more about the person and what motivates them and what their journey has been like, and how they grapple with these questions has been fascinating. And it's almost, you know, it's almost like an oral history of these things itself. So we're kind of keeping something, which, because it's a very fragile moment, and you can go back 10 years and it feels different. You know, we think about art and creative periods very much in kind of 10 or 20 year periods. And before then, it was different. And before that, it was different. And before that, and subsequently, it's different. So if you don't capture it in some way and kind of collect those voices and collect those ideas, then you don't really understand what was going on. And it's just great to scratch the surface of that, I think.
Now, what I want to talk about is something probably quite controversial in the arts sector. And I know we've wrestled with this before in a conversation we've had previously about photography and Photoshop and, you know, people winning awards and then losing the awards because they've Photoshopped it to do it, is the use of AI and on art and being creative. You know, sort of apps came along and anyone who was a graphic designer, suddenly you didn't need them to do your logo, for example, and now you've got AI that comes along and creates images and stuff like that. It's just the latest invention and what's happening, isn't it, rather than something to be feared. I mean, if you're good at art, you shouldn't fear AI, because it's, you're good at doing your thing, and just be happy with that. If other people are doing stuff, I understand it kind of interferes with people when it comes to making money and all that sort of stuff and using your art and IP. They're the questions we should be talking about, isn't it? What's driving AI to be that good, rather than is AI a necessary evil or should it exist? Well, there's nothing you can do about it. It does.
Well, there's always a history to these things. What's Sean's surname?
Carol.
The other computer arts guy.
Oh, Sean Clark.
Yeah. Sean Clark.
Too many Seans.
Too many Seans. Get me confused. Well, he traces that, and we need to get him on to talk about this because we've not had him on yet. He traces the history of computer art in Leicester, and you see, you know, there's nothing more old fashioned than a computer generated image from the 1990s or the noughties that now to our eyes look. You know, you go and see a movie that was CGI generated and it just looks entirely fake because it was entirely fake, and you've learnt to adapt to see it, whereas at the time you went to see it and you thought, oh, isn't this wonderful, isn't this, there's a phrase, very similitude, it's life, it's likeness to life, and it's like what you realise, and there's painters that do this, it's very hyper real kind of images. And we, you know, the level of sophistication of these things, but our aesthetic sense moves forward, and they, you know, nothing fades more quickly than yesterday's sense of what the future was looking like, you know, and it looks like of its time, and that's how you figure out what was going on at the time. So it's like I'm happy to see these tools come up. Me personally, I'm happy to see these tools coming along, and it gives us the opportunity to question and revalue the arts that are created by people. So it should place more value on that creative process, the people doing things themselves physically with objects and paint and pens and drawing, whatever it is, words, rather than just allowing a computer to trot it out.
So rather than concentrating that as the only thing or the next best big thing or best thing, we should look at it just as another element that's been added into that mixed media model of you can use it or you don't have to use it.
We didn't, photography didn't kill painting. You know, it didn't kill drawing. It didn't, sound recording hasn't killed concerts. It's changed them, but it doesn't stop them. There's still a need and a desire for people to do things, you know, from themselves, because there's something in that moment. It's that phrase about AI, isn't it? I want AI to do the boring things, like the dishes, so I can do the interesting things,
like my
expression. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? It's about what your approach is, I guess, and also whether you see it as a threat to your creative practice.
Yeah, and I think people have got to maybe find some confidence and stand their ground with this and say, no, it's not all about that. But it is interesting. The thinking presents some really interesting challenges to use AI and technology within art. But if you are a digital artist and you use a printer, is that any less creative than if you're using a canvas and oil paints and a spatula? It's, you know, yes, there's a different set of techniques at play there, but what is it you produce? So it raises the question, what is art? And I don't want to put that into a box and turn around and say that this is what it is, but let's just talk to other people who are doing this and working in different fields and find out, go and ask people. You know, it's a famous thing. It's like everybody's got a different definition of what they mean by community. Well, how do you find out what community is. Well, you go and talk to people and you collect those stories and you work out there's a pattern in there. And the same with art, and it'll change. Art and creativity, there's a pattern there and it will change, and people will hold certain things at some times and others at other times.
Now, a few of our guests have commented on things like COVID, and I've certainly pressed them on COVID about what they did in COVID, what it allowed them to do. And obviously I'll clarify this by saying, you know, it was a storm, but everybody was in a different size boat, so some people had a good COVID and some people didn't. So and obviously some people died and it was a terrible thing. So but for a lot of people there was the opportunity to kind of almost like defrag, if you like, or de-stress, think about what was important to them, because we just seem to have a lot more time to do things. And people have got back to what I would class as a hobby, got back into enjoying, you know, crosswords or things like that, but also reading, painting, drawing, colouring, as I mentioned before. You know, do you think COVID will be one of those things that when we reflect back on it in sort of 20, 30 years' time, it will have had an impact on the art in its broadest sense, what people do, how people relax? You know, will we have made progress against people's mental health and well-being targets because COVID allowed people the permission to go back to hobbies and things like that?
Can I see the glass half full and half empty at the same time?
Well, yeah, if you want to.
It's, you know, it's like one of those pictures where you see a vase or you see two faces. You know, it's one of those things. Yeah, I think we'll look back and go, what a complete wasted opportunity that was. We didn't use it properly. And then at the same time, we'll look back at it and say, yeah, there were some potentially interesting things came out of it. We just haven't figured out what yet. And that kind of takes time, and it takes reflection, and it takes digging into. Because I think what happened subsequently is that there's almost been like that potential to open up has now been met with a feeling of closing everything down. That guardedness has seemed to have got more pronounced than before the pandemic. So from a creativity and art point of view, people aren't quite as... It seems more difficult to do. And everybody I talk to are, you know, independent artists. There just isn't the money there. So, the expectations have shifted and changed. The funding isn't there. You have to take on another role. You have to become an art therapist. You can't just be an artist. You have to become a strategic business person. You can't just be a creative practitioner. You know, you have to have a business plan. And that's been amplified now. And it's kind of like, because the economy is working in a different way. And growth and wealth is shared through buying and selling cars, buying and selling and investing in property, probably buying and selling beer and football and those kind of things. Have been a narrowing, so it's as if, you know, there's less spaces and less opportunity to explore those things. But that's why it's good to talk to the people we've spoken to, and I think, you know, giving them a shout out. We, Anton and Sean Carroll, people that we spoke to early on, and you know, we spoke to your mum about going to galleries and her experience and things. And I think that's important. Why it's a way, almost like kind of creeping through the mist and finding out where we are. And we're not quite sure, you know, what the environment is. And we maybe need to be open to that little bit more of a process of figuring out what's going on. And I don't know the answers, but it really is nice to find out. I'm enjoying that bit.
Yeah, having those conversations. I mean, do you think also that with the way that COVID impacted, like, you know, working practices, with like working from home, people sort of maybe for the first time had taken a break from commuting or doing those kind of things, that there are people now that are being more creative and are doing for the first time actually doing something that they really want to do, because this kind of pushed them to do that?
That was the promise, and I think there's actually less of it. Because
so that's a bit of a myth, you think?
Yeah, yeah. And because it's something that we're telling ourselves to make ourselves feel nice, but in practice there isn't the evidence, I don't think, to say that we've got that popular folk culture spontaneous emergent arts, because we've not reconfigured our arts systems and our government management, and we've got this focus on the creative industries at all costs. And the analogy I've got is the shopping centre. If you imagine a shopping mall, And it's on the ground floor. It's a lot of people wandering around, kind of quite dazed and confused, and they're all on the phones and their apps, and it's like social media world. And then there's an escalator, and it goes right up to the top floor, and it misses out all of the middle floors. And on the top floor is Netflix and Amazon and Disney and the big creative industries. And there's no off-ramp or on-ramp to the middle. And so we've hollowed out the middle tiers. You know, the arts organisations are finding it very tough at the moment, and they have to go down the route of doing the audience crowd pleasing rather than necessarily the empowerment stuff, the participation stuff.
So this is John Costa with Rob Watson on Spotlight on Art. And this week we're talking about art and reflecting on some of our guests and maybe some of the things that have come out from the conversations that we've had and stuff. And we've touched on AI and COVID. And Rob, one of the things I want to talk to you about now is places to view art, you know, social media and, you know, Pinterest and these kind of things, Instagram, TikTok. They've given us opportunities to see maybe more creatives, people doing art around the world. But do you think the value of going to see it is greater than that? You know, kind of putting yourself in a situation where, like, you know, here at the LCB, going into their gallery or adult education in the basement gallery, the value goes up when you can turn around and say, actually, I like that, I don't like that, I'm going to try that, more than just sitting at home on your own going through social media where it's like, well, I'm going to give that a go, but there's no one kind of challenging you to do it or saying to you, well, actually, yours is actually better than that. Why are you feeling that way?
There's a way I like to think about this, which is, you know, that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And at the top is self-actualization. At the bottom, it's shelter, food, you know, power, you know, all those kind of things. And you've got to, and everybody, you know, I think this is a misrepresentation of what he said, but it's useful, but it's the wrong way around. Invert it, turn it the other way. You need self-actualization in order to achieve those other things. You won't have shelter and security unless you have a sense of self-actualization. What's one of the most important ways to, you know, of self-actualizing? Creative arts. It challenges us.
Expression.
And participating in that. And so if we just box everything off as a commercial product, so if our theatres, and this happens right the way across the UK, are full of, you know, well-designed, packaged touring productions, but people can't get involved and create and participate in their own and develop their own culture, if it's hard to run small rooms in pubs, events, then it's, you know, you're not going to generate anything that comes from people. You need rooms and spaces where you don't go into the room and get a lecture about things that happened 300 or 400 years ago, or this group that's been treated unfairly in the past. You go in and you look at that space for itself and for its potential now. And this is the notion of, you know, the kind of emergent arts notion, which is that the which is part of that kind of metamodern cultural moment, which is to say, you know, there's a phrase, there's a guy called Hansi Freinacht, and he says, after the deconstruction must come the reconstruction. And it's a really nice way of thinking of it. Well, we've had a kind of an arts environment where we've deconstructed everything. Postmodernism has deconstructed things. It's shown, it's turned it inside out. It's shown how it works. But then what are we for? You know, what do we do next? You know, what do we care for in our arts? And what do we care for about the human spirit and about the potential of people, rather than just merely drawing attention to all of our faults all the time, which a lot of what arts administration and arts technical organisation can do. It's almost as if you go into an art gallery and you're being told how terrible you are. You know, you're a wicked group of people, you know, and this art is going to tell you how wrong you are. And it's like, well, hang on a minute, that doesn't inspire me to do anything. I recoil from that. And I think so we have to really think through what the, you know, art presents a challenge on many levels, but it has to ultimately, it kind of has to take people forward, I think. And those visionaries that you get, that we've relied on in the past, are often dismissed at the time, but then, you know, many decades later they're rediscovered and they become important, significant figures because they were thinking ahead to something which wasn't tangible, and they have to do it through visual, sound, whatever, you know, whatever form of creative practice they use. They're trying to express something which you know, it goes beyond our present experiences.
So for you, emerging art, you know, just give me one or two examples of what emerging art is for you. If you were to describe two or three things, what is emergent art?
Oh, that's, I suppose anything that you kind of hold in a space where you don't really know what the answer is. And there's some good things. I mean, one of the things that Leicester's got is a thriving sound art scene. And it's kind of, there's people out there who are doing music performance and sound, which is kind of, you'd look at it and you'd go, I mean, it's common, there's a lot of this is done around the world, where it uses the technologies, but there's a community of people who kind of play to each other and hold regular events. But if you just at face value listen to it, you'd think that's kind of just nonsense. But when you, over time, when you listen to it, something is coming out from it and it removes the boundaries.
So one of the things that comes out from a lot of the conversations that we had around heritage and art in particular, but also, you know, what we do with, you know, teaching people, training people when it comes to being community reporters or, you know, any of that social media use, is permission. You know, waiting to have permission, or, you know, who has permission to do these things? Who do you need to get permission from before you can do that? Do you think that the challenge that comes from setting up community-based art practice venues or any of these kind of things, because of the challenge that comes with it, it seems to be like everything's against you. It's like a uphill struggle. People miss out on those kind of opportunities. If there was more of that, now I'm going to be quite nostalgic and think back to, you know, I never went to them because I was in the Sea Scouts, but there always seemed to be youth clubs and stuff like that. So therefore people had opportunities that came from those things. If you don't provide a safe space to have those opportunities, people aren't going to be able to. Some people will, but a lot of people won't do that.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, we live in a, you know, popular culture that gives us access to a world of art. You've only got to go, you know, charity shops are a really great reference point, because, you know, how many books can you pick up about the history of art in a charity shop for a pound or two?
Loads.
You know, and it's there if you look. So it's, you know, we throw this stuff away. You know, we're not very good at valuing some of these things. But I think, you know, that phrase that you used, you know, permission, nobody needs to give anybody permission. You don't need permission to think creatively and artistically. You just need to think. And that makes you unpopular. That makes you, you know, you're independent-minded and you want to express yourself and you want to follow that through. It's like, it is tough and it's difficult because there's a thumb on the scale and it's against you. And an awful lot of the institutionalized form of art. So, you know, kind of, we've got to refocus again on community driven art. And there's an argument which I'm an elitist. I actually believe in elite art, whatever we mean by that, in terms of a hierarchy of a lot. You don't go and see a Mozart or a Wagner opera with, you know, there might be times when you go and see an untrained orchestra of people who are learning, but you want to see the best in the world and they have to get there. So the director of Wigmore Hall, which is an arts a theatre in London, a music performance theatre in London, they do a lot on Radio 3, you know, was talking about they're not going to take Arts Council funding anymore because they're being expected to work as a social work team to right the wrongs of society. And they say, we are just purely, I mean, they're in a privileged position because they can get funding from big corporate organisations to sponsor them. But that doesn't devalue what community art is, and every neighbourhood should have a space, you know, an open space, not just in the centres, but it should be in the local shopping districts and neighbourhoods where there's a space for art and people to come together to have a go at creating and producing art. It has to be democratised.
I guess that's where something like Bring the Paint, focusing on, you know, street art and or graffiti, whichever way that you view that particular particular piece of wall, is important as well, isn't it? Because it's about being seen, making the place look better, improving. It's like, you know, economic regeneration. It's about, you know, neighbourhood cohesiveness. It's about, you know, do you feel safe?
But you shouldn't have to tick all of those boxes first to do something which is of an artistic creative expression
in order to get the funding to do
them, but that's unfortunate. That's the system that we've got at the moment, and it's, you know, if we could change that, you know, you don't need permission from the lottery or the funding organization, like the council or whoever. You need permission to paint on the side of somebody's building, don't get me wrong, and you want to keep it within the realms of public decency, but, you know, why should you need permission? and that it has to meet these certain outcomes in order to get you funding. If you're a group of creative people and you just want to make your statement, that's what we should be encouraging, and get rid of the rest.
So, like, allowing people opportunities to express their culture, their community, their heritage and all those kind of things, and their creativity in a way that best fits them, rather than trying to get it to fit into a matrix or a rubric, which is about funding and what's your outcomes. It's just fun to do.
It's the Justin O'Connor book, and I'd recommend anybody to read that. Culture is not an industry, and it's, you know, we should move beyond that. It's about cultural democracy. It's about my creative expression matters, or your creative expression matters as much as anybody else's, and you don't need permission to have the desire to want to express yourself creatively. Just get on, and, you know, we need to create spaces where people can get on and do it.
So, Rob, let's bring this recording to an end now for Spotlight on Arts. It's been great talking to those 10 people that we've had so far, and it's certainly made me think, and I've been making a list here of we need to get that person on. I'd forgotten about them. We should get those on to help us move some of these conversations forward. From your perspective, do you consider yourself creative or artistic, or is there anything that you do that is creative or artistic? How about editing this podcast?
That's not particularly a creative job. It's a task. I was just sitting here thinking, I've been listening to a lot of these things each week, and I don't say very much in the programmes themselves, but I've taken it on board. And I hope from a listener's perspective, we'd really appreciate some feedback, you know, to kind of get in contact via Source Sound. All the podcasts are available back on Source Sound. I think it's when you have somebody like Lisa and Dean that we were talking to, was just great. It was like, kind of, they just approach it with a sense of honesty.
There was something authentic about that podcast.
Yeah, and Tim previous to that.
Yeah,
and
Tim Grayson inventing the game in lockdown. Yeah.
Everybody we've spoken to, they've just had a kind of sense of, oh, you want to talk to me kind of thing. No airs and graces. You know, just you know, there's no titles. You don't have to doff your cap. This is the segregation, the cultural segregation that we've got is really counterproductive. And it's like, it's just ordinary people, and they're no more entitled or no better or worse than anybody else. And it's just, that's the approach that we've got to take. You do all the same things that everybody else does. Yeah, you might have read a few more books and learned a few more words. It doesn't mean to say that you've got any more insight in terms of what beauty is, or what, what art can achieve, because everybody has an individual relationship with that, and it can transform people once you've opened up to that. And that's kind of what I think we miss is thinking about, and I think I myself are reflecting on this, is that we don't have enough spaces where you can visit, where you can just contemplate, you know, like museums. That's why cathedrals are popular, but they're part of the heritage industry, and you have tours around them, and you've got to learn about the history, and you can't just go into a space anymore and just be in that space and use it as a place for personal reflection, looking at the images. We're fortunate, we do have some great museums in the UK, but you've got to get to them. And the expectation is that it's not just about footfall when you visit a museum or an art gallery. It's actually about transformation. And you put work, you commission artists, and you show the work of artists on the basis that these have a potential to change people's lives. And so we've got to take it seriously.
Yeah. But do you think there's also too much emphasis put on the fact that there needs to be a reason for you to do it, or for you to have a purpose to do what you do?
Well, the purpose should be itself. You know, it should just define itself. Is that, you know, that transcendent moment that you get when the epiphany of the, it's like the light bulb moment, whatever you want to call it, when you're looking at a piece of work art, when you're looking at something and you suddenly go, I remember being in a gallery in France in Nantes, and I was in this modern art gallery in this section of the museum. It was a fantastic museum. And there's this guy, and he was walking around, he's like working class guy, and he's really agitated by all the pictures on the wall. And I don't speak French, so I wanted to say to him, the clothes that he was wearing, he's like wearing sports gear, so he wouldn't have been designed if these modernist painters hadn't been doing these geometric kind of images on the walls. And he was really, and his wife was stood over the other side of the gallery. She was clearly frustrated with him being so agitated. But he had a physical reaction to it. And that's what art is about. It changes your perspective of the world.
Yeah, and your place in it.
And who you are within that.
And, you know, how you should view it and how you engage in it, and then what you do with that information is down to you. It's a very personal thing rather than something that you should do in a formulaic way. So Rob, listen, I've enjoyed this reflection, first spotlight on art, and I've enjoyed all the conversations that we've had over the last couple of 12 weeks really, and look forward to the next 12 weeks.
Yeah, and go and check out the Soar Sound website, because they're all available as podcasts, and we're going to look forward to doing some more.